From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're talking about new Hanover Regional Medical Center, the once county-owned hospital that was sold to Novant Health several years ago. Now, there's been a fair amount of reporting on NHRMC, including a death at the hospital 2 years ago that put the hospital at risk of sanctions from the federal government. Other anecdotal stories continue to leak out of the hospital. Here at WHQR, we've interviewed several folks on the record recently, and I've received dozens of emails, messages, and phone calls from people who have had bad experiences. Now, these stories are troubling and often very personal, and I'm grateful to the people who have shared their experiences with us, and you'll likely be hearing more about some of them on HQR in the coming weeks and months. But the story we're telling today is one that really stood out to me. John Martell is a retired doctor and former hospital administrator. When he and his wife first sat down with me back in March, the story they told floored me. Martell told me bluntly the hospital had nearly killed him. But it wasn't just that. Based on his medical background and his experience working on quality control in hospitals, he was able to clearly articulate exactly what went wrong, as you'll hear on today's show. Martell was also able to lay out what could change to prevent it from happening again. I want to note that HIPAA, the federal patient privacy laws, prevent NHRMC or any hospital from discussing the details of a specific incident. But Novant did agree to talk about some of the systemic issues that Martell raised, and you can hear some of that interview at the end of today's show. I also want to say, and I think Martell would agree with me here, that nothing we're talking about today is intended to disparage healthcare workers. And it's important to understand today's story in the context of a national crisis in healthcare, an incredible level of burnout, the lingering psychological stress and trauma from the COVID pandemic, low morale, and a broken healthcare insurance system that has all kinds of negative knock-on effects for patients and hospitals alike. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. But in spite of that, thousands of dedicated, talented people keep at it in our community. For me, after talking to Martell several times, his story isn't about how healthcare workers are failing. It's about how healthcare is failing those workers and the patients that they care for. All right, my guest now is John Martell. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Ben.
So just to start, can you give people a sense of your background and your roles in medicine and hospital administration?
I grew up in Durham and wound up going to my hometown medical school, which is Duke. After Duke, I did a residency in Texas and then wound up having a career as a physician out in Hawaii for 40 years. It was a wonderful career, just absolutely wonderful career. I started a healthcare for the homeless project, which is still running. I taught with the medical school. I taught with the residency. And for the last 5 years of my career, I was the chief medical officer for a rural small hospital on the Big Island of Hawaii. In that role, I spent most of my time helping with quality initiatives, quality improvement, creating a high reliability medical organization. And then when I had finished those 5 years, I moved to Wilmington to be close to family.
And recently, you had what I think listeners will agree was kind of a disturbing experience. I might be putting this too lightly, but a disturbing experience at the New Hanover Regional Medical Center. As comfortable as you are with that, tell people what happened to you.
I had settled into a retirement here in Wilmington. As best physicians can retire, we're really bad at it. But I was volunteering with a couple of organizations, working at a free and charitable clinic, paddling outrigger canoes. Basically, my life as a retiree was pretty good. Then on March 10th of this year, New Hanover Regional Medical Center almost killed me. I know that sounds dramatic, but that's how it felt at the time. And now with a couple months of perspective behind it, I still feel that way. Can I explain what happened?
Yeah, so as you explained to me, you went in for what should have been a fairly routine procedure, and it just went completely off the rails. I mean, tell people what happened.
Yes, absolutely. So the first week in March, I developed an infected gallbladder. Being a physician, I did what most physicians do, which is I waited too late to get medical attention. By the time I got to the emergency room, my gallbladder was pretty infected. So I knew the surgery had some risk to it, but it is a routine surgery. They do what's called a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. They inflate your belly. They go in with a robot with lasers and fiber optics. It's really very cool, and they go in and they wiggle your gallbladder out and pop it through the abdominal wall, and they seal everything up, and it's all good. Now, I went in knowing that there was a risk that my surgery would be more complicated because of the infection. I also went in knowing that the hospital was a two-star hospital and that there was some issue regarding patient care there, but I figured, no problem. I'm a physician. I'm smart. I can advocate for myself. I know the ropes. This is not going to be a big deal. Let's just do this.
And we're going to come back to this two-star idea, but I don't want to interrupt your story. I just want people to keep that in mind.
So the surgery went pretty much as you expected. I went through the operation, went through recovery, wound up in my room on the surgery ward. And that was Sunday afternoon, about noon, that I got up there. At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 1:15, my blood pressure dropped. I got all sweaty. I got confused. I got dizzy. And my blood pressure dropped below 90 systolic. Essentially, that's the definition of shock. And it's pretty much a medical emergency. They laid me flat. They called the resident on call who came in, took a brief look at me, said, okay, we're going to give you some fluids. We're going to do some labs. I asked him, should I go to intensive care unit because I'm in shock? Should we set up a higher level of care in the room because I'm in shock? And he said, no, we can deal with this here. So I got some fluids. My blood pressure came up. My labs were not horrible. They weren't normal, but they weren't disastrous. And I was told that everything was going to be okay. I'd stay right in the room, that it was all manageable, no problem. The resident left, and 15 minutes later, I went back into shock.
Wow.
Then they laid me down flat. I asked them actually to lower the head of my bed so that I could stay conscious during all of this. And I was absolutely dumbfounded because nothing was happening. I was back in shock. I know what's supposed to happen when somebody's in shock. You call an emergency team, you get in an extra IV, you run lots of fluids, you get an electrocardiogram, you put them on telemetry monitoring to watch their heart, and you treat it like an emergency. And nothing was happening. So I got the nurses in, I said, nothing's happening. Can we get the rapid response team here? And rapid response is a group of nurses trained in intensive care who can assess difficult, complicated patients. And they call them to units when patients decompensate to stabilize it. So the rapid response team was called. I asked the nurses to put in a second IV for me because nobody had done that. I never saw the rapid response. They got turned away at the door.
And I've asked a number of other physicians about that particular detail that you told me. And they have said that really no one should basically abort that mission of the emergency team until they get to your room, check on you, and they basically determine that their job is done, not anyone else, right?
That's exactly right. And I have personally seen in my practice a couple of medical catastrophes that related to stopping the rapid response team or the code team before they got their work done. So I know how dangerous that is.
So at this point, your condition is deteriorating, and you're in the room with your wife at this point, right?
Yes. And when my blood pressure drops the second time, she looked at me and she said, what happens now? And I said, well, this is going to be rough. Call your niece to come in and be with you because I don't know what's going to happen next. So we called the niece in. She got there about an hour later. But I finally got another resident in the room, said, the first resident didn't think I was bleeding, didn't think I was in septic shock, but I'm in shock. Can we do something? Can we at least activate the sepsis protocol, which is a set of standing orders done in a set sequence for somebody who is in shock due to infection? And he said, fine, we'll do the sepsis protocol. And then I knew at least I'd get the fluids. And if the fluids didn't work, I would get a medicine to support my blood pressure called norepinephrine. So this is all going on. Meantime, my belly is filling up with blood. I don't know this for sure, but it is. And my pain is going up and up and up and up. And I can't get pain medicine. The reason is that pain medicine drops your blood pressure. So there I am. I'm upside down. My blood pressure is 80. I've got 10 out of 10 pain. I've got fluids running. Nobody's talking to me. I have to ask the nurses, where are we? Have we got the first unit of fluids in, the first liter? And they say, yeah. And I said, okay, can we start the second? And they start the second, and nobody's talking to me, and my blood pressure is still in the toilet. And I go, well, where are we with the second liter of fluid? Well, we've got 100 cc's. I said, has the norepinephrine been placed in the system? They said, yes. I said, go ahead and start it. About that time, the surgeons made the decision to take me back to the operating room. That came sort of as an announcement out of the blue. Okay, we think you need to go back to the OR.
How much time had transpired?
My blood pressure dropped the second time at about 2:15, and I got to the operating room about 4:30, 4:40. But from the initial drop in blood pressure, which was the warning sign, that was a sentinel event where things should have clicked in and been happening, it was 3.5 hours.
I have to ask, at this point, you have been, is it an exaggeration to say that you were at risk of dying at this point?
No, absolutely I was at risk.
Okay.
And the point that my niece, who's a veterinarian who was in the room, and my wife, who is a retired nurse, made is, had it been anybody else, they very well may not have made it, because they wouldn't know to call for the fluids and get the blood pressure support medicine in line to be used.
So you're on your way out, so to speak, and you were calling your own codes.
Absolutely.
And you told me your niece said something comparing the care you were getting to the care she's used to seeing in her line of work.
Yeah, and she's a veterinarian. And I think, and I can't quote you exactly because I'm upside down with a blood pressure of 70, but she basically says we treat our Labrador retrievers better than this.
That stuck with me.
Yeah.
Okay, so they take you to the surgical theater.
Right. Half my blood volume is in my belly at that point, seriously. And so they go in, they find the bleeding point, they stop that, they spend a couple of hours cleaning all the blood out of my belly, stitch everything back up, and off I go to intensive care unit, which is probably where I should have been earlier, but that's a moot point. I get to intensive care unit, the bleeding stopped, my kidneys have been damaged, thankfully, temporarily. They recovered by the time I got out of the hospital, and then I go through the process of recovery. What is stunning is this whole event happened on Sunday. It should have automatically triggered a notification to the head of the nursing unit that a serious event occurred, you got to look into it, not a peep. Nobody came to the bedside, said, you know, this was a bad thing that happened. We're going to look into it. We're going to fix it. Not a peep. I did not see the director of the nursing unit until my discharge 2 days later. And only after I asked the nurse on duty to go get him and explain to him what had happened to me. So he was, 2 days later, he was clueless that all this had happened.
So you had just had a brush with death. You're in the ICU and nothing.
Nothing.
All right. Well, on that note, we need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we'll have more with John Martell talking about his experience at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. And we're going to pivot to some of the systemic issues behind that experience that Martell has identified. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. We're speaking today with John Martell, a retired doctor and former hospital administrator whose brush with death at New Hanover Regional Medical Center inspired him to speak out about some of the systemic issues he sees there. You were able to identify, you know, maybe at the time, maybe some later, but a number of more systemic things that are going on here that deepen this story. So it's not just like a couple of, you know, off-the-cuff mistakes were made. Like there's deeper issues going on here. And if it's okay, I want to get into some of those now.
Yeah, absolutely. What you'll notice, Ben, is that at no point have I blamed the nurses, the residents, the surgeon, anybody specifically at the hospital. Because in order to screw up this badly, there have to be systemic problems. The issue is not an individual nurse or an individual resident. It is the whole culture. It is the whole set of treatment protocols, the way they handle events, the way they deal with quality improvement that's got to be wrong. And because quality improvement was my background, I could see all of these, and I could see them fairly clearly. One example, when the first resident came in and said, this is no big deal, we'll fix it with a little fluid, that set up a judgment error that persisted through the whole acute event, which is by his getting closure too early, saying, okay, this is all good. He locked the residents and the nurses into a mindset that this was trivial and no higher care needed to be delivered. That's a very dangerous situation. The first assumption of a medical resident coming in to see somebody in shock is that it's the worst possible thing it could be. And then when you eliminate all those, you can back off. But they didn't do an electrocardiogram. I could have been in cardiac shock for all they knew. Belly pain and shock easily could be cardiac. I could have been in septic shock. And it was developing rather than it's easily treated and done. So they locked the mindset, and the organization and the culture was unable to reassess and say, wait, this isn't going the way it's supposed to. Let's reset. Let's start all over again. Let's treat it like the medical emergency that it is and take care of it.
I want to talk about this a little bit more because we at HQR have heard from a number of patients who have experienced variations on this, where whatever their initial intake or the first resident that saw them sort of set them on a path, and evidence to the contrary, they stayed on that path with the treatment they received. And I'm curious, I'm a total layperson here, but what could be different that would have allowed this to unfold differently, that would have allowed someone to course correct?
Well, partly that's why I wanted the rapid response team there, because they deal with this and they know problems, they know trouble when they see it. So I was trying to get somebody external to readjust, but really it's a cultural thing. You teach the residents, you teach the nurses, you teach the nursing aides, you teach the folks who clean the rooms to look at the situation in the current moment and decide whether something needs to be done or not, not based on what you thought an hour ago. In the moment, where are you right now? That's a cultural thing, and that's something that can be worked on with the administration of the hospital.
Another issue I want to talk about is, you mentioned this when we first spoke, and I've looked into it a bit, and that has to do with basically the electronic monitoring systems of how the hospital, if it wants to, can see what's going on with patients and maybe how that might have been an opportunity for this to go differently.
Yeah. New Hanover has a very sophisticated electronic medical record. It has all of the laboratory data. It has all of the vital signs. It has all of the imaging results. And systems like this are set up so that if you use it, they can do surveillance. They can, in real time, look at the patient's blood pressure, the patient's white count, the diagnosis, the respiratory rate, the oxygen levels. And even if the nurses aren't aware that the patient's getting into trouble, the electronic record knows that that patient is in trouble and can trigger an alert in the system. There's a system called the Medical Early Warning Score that uses your vital signs and other data. In my hospital, we set it up to recognize evidence of sepsis and trigger a sepsis alert automatically. There was no evidence to me that this was being utilized in their system.
To me, sort of a related part of that about listening to someone else besides that first resident is just listening to the patients. You know, that seems like as low tech as it gets, but you have a medical background, your wife has a medical background. It is my sense that you definitely felt like you weren't being listened to.
And that's alarming, because if I'm not being listened to, you know that the patients without that background are really not being listened to. One thing that I believe very strongly is that you have to listen to the patient and the patient's family. They know when the patient's getting into trouble. They know when their husband's thinking is getting strange or their breathing is off, far better than the nurses know. And if you ignore that, you do it at the peril of the patient. It really costs you nothing as a nurse or a physician to go in and do the assessment based on what the family is notifying you about. Because if there is nothing there, you've done your diligence and you can reassure the patient and the family. But if there is something there, it could very well be a valuable catch. At one point, believe this, I'm not making this up. My wife was so distressed, she pressed the code button. Now, the code button is in every room. It activates an emergency response team with everything, defibrillators, the equipment to intubate you and put you on a respirator, the whole thing. The nurse walked over, unclicked the code button, said, "No, we don't do that." My hospital back in Hawaii, and I don't want to reference my hospital too much because I don't know whether it's typical nationwide, the families were allowed to push the code button and the code would activate just like you said. It goes from the activation until the head of the code team is sure that there is not an issue, and then they close it. If there is no code situation and the family has pushed the button in error, it's no problem. You reassured the patient.
I have to ask, because people will wonder, do you feel like, obviously, you had the benefit of having, you know, a deep medical background on both sides of the administrative side and the practicing side. So you knew a lot of what was going on here. Do you think there's any way that could have contributed negatively in that, you know, some residents like, "Oh, doctors are the worst patients. This guy's just trying to boss me around"?
I have no idea. That has certainly crossed my mind. Yes. Was I a demanding patient? Maybe. But if you look at the situation, I couldn't be faulted for being demanding.
Not at death's door. No, probably not. All right. Another thing you told me was that you feel like New Hanover Regional Medical Center is practicing what you call hands-off medical care. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So one of the things I did was when I was with the medical school is I taught physical exam. And we had a very vigorous course on examination of the lungs, the heart, everything. And we made sure that our medical students were up to a standard of physical exam that we considered safe for the practice of medicine. The licensing boards actually require, I don't know what happened with COVID, but they required all graduating medical students to pass a standardized physical exam test. From the time I hit the emergency room on Friday evening to the time I was discharged on Wednesday morning, I had a total of 2 adequate physical exams. One was by the surgical resident who did my admission, and the other was by a senior member of the nursing staff who did the best physical exam of anybody in the whole hospital. I was shocked. Somebody goes into a critical situation. You listen to their heart. You listen to their lungs. You examine their legs for possibility of clot. There's a great number of things that you really should do. None of that was done. COVID is responsible for some of this loss of clinical skills, that when you practice telemedicine, you can't listen to heart and lungs. When you've got a large number of COVID patients and you're in PPE and you've got to take care of everybody, you do shortcuts, but that's over. Okay, we should be back to a hands-on standard of care.
You mentioned that this seems almost surreal, but you were in the ICU recovering and there was no mention of it. And that follow-up, you know, you basically told me that, you know, if they're not catching these things that are happening, it's not just about what happened to you. It's what else do they not know? It's the unknown unknowns, right? What else don't they know is happening in their own hospital?
To create a high reliability medical care facility, you need to know everything bad that happens and everything bad that might have happened in that facility from the very beginning all the way through. You just need to keep track of that. And that means that events, even if they're trivial, need to be captured and they need to be dealt with through a process where you look at the event, you analyze where the failures were, and create systemic fixes to those failures so that not only that event doesn't happen again, but similar events also won't occur. You know, there are many organizations that use this process outside of the medical system. Probably one of the best examples is in aerospace and flights. You know, the captains have checklists. They know how to go through and analyze everything. All problems are reported. All problems are analyzed. And solutions are put in place. Nuclear energy has the same thing. In aerospace, we can see with Boeing what happens when you stop following that culture of monitoring and fixing everything. But, you know, the models are out there, and it's no different from healthcare.
I think some, again, this is strictly anecdotal, so I want to be clear about that. But some of the stories I've heard portray a kind of no harm, no foul attitude where things didn't get addressed or documented because there was no negative outcome, but there clearly could have been. And I talked to one patient who used the analogy. It was like, I drove drunk, but I didn't hit anyone, so it's fine. I won't do it. I promise not to do it again. And I feel like what you're saying is that if you don't understand even the bad things that could have happened but didn't, then you're setting yourself up for patient harm in the future.
Absolutely. These events are called near misses in the culture of safety jargon. The near misses actually are predictive of real events. And if you can get the near misses where the wrong medicine was almost given to the patient, or the wrong blood was almost given to a different patient, or an equipment failure almost didn't get recognized, if you can fix those near misses in a systemic way, you can avoid the big events. They've looked at high reliability teams versus low functioning teams in medical care. The high reliability teams report all their incidents. It looks paradoxical because the high reliability teams have this long list of incidents that's happened on their unit, but they're fixing them. The low reliability units don't identify them, they don't fix them, and there are consequences.
So I want to come back to something we talked about earlier, and that is the two-star Hospital. This is the United States Department of Health and Human Services Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services.
Yeah, that's quite a mouthful.
CMS.
CMS.
And so CMS rates hospitals on a 5-star scale for, I guess, you know, quality and safety, and then there's a separate scale for based on patient surveys. And so the last couple of times I've checked, and we've done some reporting on this that we'll have links to that people can check out, but like New Hanover Regional Medical Center is a 2-star out of 5-star hospital, which Novant has defended saying, well, that's only part of the picture, but I want to get your perspective on what does that 2-star hospital rating mean?
So this is a very, very important subject, which is when you look at a rating and it goes from 2-star to 5-star, it's often easy to equate it to a Yelp rating.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, if you go to a 2-star restaurant, you know, the waiter's surly, the food is cold, they don't serve the drinks on time, and you have a lousy experience and then leave. In the hospital star rating, CMS is looking at actual quality data. They're looking at death rates. They're looking at complication rates. If you are at a 2-star hospital, the death rates and the complication rates are higher than for a 3-star hospital, definitely higher than a 4, and definitely higher than a 5. So lives are at stake. When you say it's a 2-star hospital, there are lives on the line.
So more people are getting infections through their catheter and their main line, more surgical wounds are bursting open, more people are dying from serious but treatable conditions. Like that's numbers out of 1,000. Like this is hard data
Yes.
that the feds have.
And that data is available for anybody to look at. That you go to the CMS Hospital Compare website and you plug in your hospital and it shows you all the data on selected complications and selected death rates. And you can look at what's happening in your hospital. Then you can go and look at what's happening in a 5-star hospital and you can compare the two. And I can give you some comparisons if you want.
Sure.
For example, and this is published data, this is what CMS is coming up with. Chronic obstructive lung disease is a common and very serious illness. At New Hanover, the death rate for patients with chronic obstructive lung disease who are admitted for treatment is 12.1%. It's a bad disease. People are going to die. But if you look at the average nationwide, the rate is 9.2%. If you look at Duke, it's 9.1%. What that means in real terms, and let's see if I can anchor it for you, is that for every 100 people with COPD admitted to the hospital, there will be 3 excess deaths at a 2-star hospital at New Hanover.
Wow.
Okay. And you can follow the trend. The same trend follows for congestive heart failure. Every 100 admissions, 3 excess deaths at New Hanover. Pneumonia, every 100 admissions, roughly 4 excess deaths. So this is important. This is our community. These are our parents. These are our loved ones that are going in and carrying this excess risk. I think the numbers pretty much speak for themselves. I don't really know what else to say about this except we deserve better than this. We need better than this.
I do hear this when I talk to people about this issue. Hospitals are a rough place. I mean, people go there on the worst day of their lives all the time. People go there with terrifying injuries and fatal diseases, and people are going to die. There's no hospital in which no one dies. But we are talking about avoidable deaths, and I want to be careful with this term, is that, you know, there are unavoidable deaths that you cannot blame on the hospital, but there are probably hospitals that if they had different resources or did things differently or had a different culture, fewer people would die. That's fair to say.
I think that that's absolutely fair to say. And you can't go from the general to the specific. You can't say these specific patients would have survived at Duke, but in general, there's going to be 3 excess deaths per 100 admissions for chronic obstructive lung disease in this hospital.
One of the reasons that this resonates with people is I have certainly been places, you know, rural community hospitals. They are struggling with resources, with manpower, with people power. And this is not that. This is a hospital that we had, I think at one point, a half dozen suitors, some of the best and most well-resourced medical systems in the region were jockeying, were competing, were suitors for this, for New Hanover Regional Medical Center as a county-owned hospital. And I don't think it's unfair to say, I don't think it's an understatement to say, we were promised that we were going to sell it to the people who would deliver the best hospital for New Hanover County and an 8-9 county region. And when I hear stories like this and when I tell people stories like this, what I feel like is that it's not that we like didn't get our money's worth. It's that we didn't get what we were promised, which was an excellent hospital.
So I really can't speak to that. I wasn't here for the transition. And I can't really address what is being done in the hospital right now. What I can tell you is that resources should not be an issue here. I have worked with two hospitals that have taken themselves from 3-star to 5-star. One is Castle Hospital on Oahu. They did it by concerted effort to change the culture. Hilo Medical Center, where I was the chief medical officer, we engaged a group called Studer, whose real emphasis was on creating a quality culture, a fairness culture where people don't get blamed for errors. And we took that from a 3 to 5-star with no increase in resources. The paradoxical thing, Ben, is if you take a 2-star hospital to a 4-star hospital, everybody's going to fall all over you to give you money to improve your heart center, to improve your cancer center. They're not going to do that for a 2-star hospital. So first of all, the resources are not limiting. It can be done on a limited budget, but the rewards are enormous.
Just to bring this back down to like a very personal level, something you told me was that there may have been opportunities in your experience where a nurse could have said something, the second resident who came to your room could have said something, and a culture in which they felt more empowered to do that would cost virtually nothing compared to, in terms of dollars and cents.
In terms of dollars and cents, it really doesn't cost very much. In terms of effort, I'm not going to pretend that it isn't a heavy lift. The entire hospital needs to be committed to a safety culture, committed to zero harm. But if they commit, it can be done. And I want to be clear, quality is local, that it's incumbent on the folks who are in our hospital right now, running our hospital, to make this happen. It is not incumbent on a bigger organization. The changes have to be local or they don't take.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break. But when we come back, we'll have more with John Martell, who's been speaking with us about his experience at New Hanover Regional Medical Center. And we'll hear about the nonprofit he is standing up to help address the issues that he's been talking about on today's show. We'll also hear from some of Novant's top medical staff to get their perspective on this story. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. We've been speaking with John Martell, a retired doctor and former hospital administrator who has shared his experiences at New Hanover Regional Medical Center and his insights into the systemic issues he believed caused that experience. Up now, we'll hear more about the nonprofit he is creating to help address those issues. And we'll hear from two top Novant administrators to get their take on this story. You took away from this experience, this admittedly rather negative experience, a desire to see things change. And I want you to talk a little bit about where you have set about and how you've set about doing that.
It's really interesting, Ben, because when I got through with this episode, I wasn't angry. I wasn't vengeful. I didn't want to make anybody suffer for the event I went through. But what I had was I had a certain clarity that I was uniquely qualified to see where the problems were and to educate the community. And then once the education is done, to advocate for the changes that need to be made. It's a heavy lift because I'm an outsider to the institution, but it's the position I've been given. I've been given a story that I can tell that clearly exemplifies the problems. I have the knowledge to know what those problems are, and I have the motivation to do something about it. So I have set up a private nonprofit. It's called the Cape Fear Five-Star Project. We are going to start educating the community on health care in New Hanover County, with some emphasis on what goes on in the hospital. And then once we get that going, we're going to start advocating for the changes that need to be made. There are things that residents of our county and the surrounding counties can do. If you are at all concerned about the hospital and it's possible, you can look at outcomes and pick a different hospital to go get your procedure. You should know your patient bill of rights. You should have a negotiator, an advocate go with you for your health care, and the person you want is the person who's not afraid to speak truth to power, the one who will stand up and tell a doctor off, or will tell a nurse off, or will stand there and say, no, you got to call the code. That's who you want on your side.
So if this resonates with people, if they've had an experience like yours, if they know someone who has had an experience like this, or they just think that healthcare in their community is important, how do they get involved? What can they do to help?
Ben, I'm somewhat making this up as I go along. I'm just standing the organization up. There will be tools on my website, letters to the legislature, ways to advocate locally. And then we need, as a community, to simply let the hospital know that we are watching and that we will hold them accountable, and that another 2-star rating is not acceptable, that a 3-star rating actually isn't acceptable either, that what we need is a 4- or 5-star hospital, and we just need to keep the pressure on. I just don't see any other way to approach it.
Well, we will have links to the Cape Fear 5-Star Project, the nonprofit that you've started. But for now, John Martell, you've been very generous with your time, and I really appreciate you sharing your story with us.
I just appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk with you and to get all of this out there.
All right. Up now, my guests are Dr. Heather Davis and Amy Akers from Novant Health. They've generously agreed to take some time out of their busy schedule to talk, at least at a general level, about some of the issues that we touched on in today's show. All right, Heather and Amy, if I could have you introduce yourselves so people can recognize your voices throughout this interview.
Yeah, it's Dr. Heather Davis, and I'm the Chief Clinical Officer of Novant Health Coastal Region.
This is Amy Akers. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at Novant Health New Hanover Regional Medical Center, as well as our coastal region.
Thank you both for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to talk about this with us this morning. I know that you cannot speak to any specific patient protected by HIPAA, but I'm hoping we can get into some of the broader systemic issues that I've heard from on-the-record interviews we've done over the last couple months. Just to get started, the first one is we've heard recurring stories where, from the point of view of the patient, they feel like the medical staff gets locked into whatever the initial sort of patient treatment plan is and don't reassess later. And that's led to some frustration when there's been issues of patients deteriorating or, you know, things not being as they appeared initially. Can you speak to that issue in general at all?
Yes. So I think that the most important thing is, you know, we really work as a care team for ongoing assessment and evaluation of our patients. And you know, we see our patients as part of that team. And you know, while there's a lot going on in the background, and certainly things that can happen very quickly, you know, it is our priority to work together collaboratively as the clinical care team, for communication, reassessments, and decision making, and really including, again, our patients and communicating with them through that time to make sure that we're all, understanding kind of what current state is, and also, the goals and treatment plan for the patient's care.
I mean, can I ask if you've heard in general any concerns about this, about, patients feeling like, for example, the most recent interview we did, a patient had come out of surgery and felt like he was experiencing either sepsis or internal bleeding or both. Again, from his point of view, nurses and the resident were very hesitant to reevaluate. Have you heard stories like that, or do you feel like this might be a one-off?
I think as far as, not discounting any one experience, but really the important thing and the piece that we value the most is our patient's voice and hearing from them, again, as part of their care, and taking all of that feedback really seriously. We take care of hundreds of thousands of patients every year, and we actively seek their viewpoint, their experience, and really overwhelmingly, receive positive responses and see that trend of patient experience, trending positively, and extremely proud of the team that's providing that care. And certainly, when we do have any feedback or voice from that patient of an experience, that we bring that back to our team and evaluate, so that the any clinical situation that or experience they have is not positive, that we address that and not have that occur, for any other future patient.
Ben, I would add, this is Amy, I would add that, whether that is a physical assessment, hands-on, or through the use of our advanced technology that's working in the background, that's also providing information to that care team about any changes that might be happening with patients that they utilize through their team meetings, their collaboration, and making any needed changes to the care plan that is currently in place.
You mentioned hands-on, hands-on exams maybe. One of the other concerns I've heard sort of repeatedly is that people have reported, and again, this is anecdotal, but people have reported what they've described as a hands-off approach at NHRMC, being consulted from the doorway or from the computer console, not getting up close and personal exams more than maybe once or twice in a 4 or 5 day period. Some folks have actually suggested that this could be lingering COVID protocols. I'm just curious if you can speak to that, that issue in general.
As far as, the exam and the care team and their interaction with patients, that's part of our daily protocols to evaluate, reassess, and have that care team, come in and evaluate the patient, and again, work with patients and families to provide the updates and insights and discuss that treatment plan. But, I think as far as having those experiences, again, those are the things that we value and hear the voice of our patient to address, if that's ever what someone does experience in our care.
I know that some of the stories we have heard were from the height of the pandemic. And so I think it's been reasonably well reported out that there were pretty serious staffing issues in, say, 2021 into 2022. Can you speak at all to, have things improved and stabilized from that point?
We absolutely were not immune to the current national nursing shortage in particular, as well as the after effects from the pandemic. We've been able to significantly reduce the number of travel nurses with actual permanent nurses In fact, we've had over 70 of our travel nurses that decided to make Wilmington or New Hanover County their permanent home. Because of the culture here, because they have a voice in decisions, and because of the focus that they see we have on patient safety, patient quality, and patient experience.
Speaking of culture, I know that morale, and again, understandably, was a severe problem during the height of the pandemic for lots of reasons, probably aggravated by friction between traveling nurses and in-house nurses. Is it your sense that maybe some of those morale problems have been alleviated because of the improvements you've just described?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we brought in the travel nurses. We needed travel nurses. We had travel nurses prior to the pandemic, but have made them part of the family and part of the improvements that we continuously are making.
One of the things I'm still hearing from current patients that I heard in 2022 is that, this is anecdotal, but I've heard it repeatedly, is that it is the sense from patients that near misses are not making it up the signal chain. The wrong medication is almost dispensed, or, you know, the wrong knee is almost identified for a replacement surgery, or fluids not replaced, but they thought it what they were. And, you know, maybe the floor nurse, forgive me if my terminology is off, but like the head nurse on the floor is not aware that these things have happened. Nothing bad happened, but they're not aware that there were near misses. How do you guys see that issue on a more general scale? How do you track bad things that don't happen but almost happened?
Yeah, so we have numerous safety and quality initiatives and committees and programs and ways that really are the foundation of our culture here and our teams, that when they see those things or experience those things, of ways of reporting and how those are shared, and really in a real time, soon after that, we evaluate each one of those as, any opportunity for a change in our protocols and our processes, and really disseminating that information. But that's really foundational to our culture to share those, because that's part of our journey to continuous improvement. And so we do have numerous initiatives and tools to support that.
And Ben, I would say we not only encourage, our team members to report what you've described as near misses, but to report any opportunity for improvement they might see without it even being a near miss. And those near misses that do get reported through our system are something that Dr. Davis and myself actually see on a daily basis. So every 24 hours, we're reviewing those reports and providing feedback, and not only sharing that with our team here at New Hanover Regional Medical Center, or our coast, but across Novant Health. Which has been one of the big advantages of becoming part of Novant Health, is that we're able to share and grow and make improvements at a grander scale, and in a quicker fashion as well.
Are there areas where you guys are aware that you need to improve on, or do you feel like the hospital is where it needs to be?
This is always a journey for continuous improvement. And so, the areas that we've looked at, obviously there's, national reporting tools and things that we utilize, but really it's our numerous tools and initiatives that we're identifying, again, real time, what opportunities are, that as we've been working on our safety and quality initiatives and looking at our data, that's where we're really proud of the work that our team has done and the focused efforts on areas where, we know that there's opportunities for improvement and have continued to see that improvement. Again, utilizing all of these tools or surveys or evaluation methods that we have, looking at where those opportunities have been and seeing that we're seeing continuous improvement.
I mean, that's your internal evaluation, which is obviously critical. In terms of outside evaluators like LeapFrog Foundation or the Center or CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, right now the federal government, as of last July, gives the hospital 2 out of 5 stars. Navant has told me in the past, you know, that doesn't paint the entire picture of the hospital, and I understand that. But is there any long-term plan to address that grade, to try and, over the next 5 years, get to 3 stars or get to 4 stars? Or are you more focused on just sort of your own internal metrics?
Yeah, we look at those as an opportunity to really compare to other facilities, but really utilizing our own metrics here. And again, you know, the LeapFrog or CMS, those things, while we know, you know, they're snapshots and kind of a high level, you know, picture, but not really a focus on all of the areas that we focus on with safety and quality. While we certainly continue to strive every day, you know, with continuous improvement, you know, in the safety quality journey, we know that there are things within those where opportunities are, but there's a whole lot more that we do, you know, on a more granular level and specific focus areas that we put our efforts to, again, reach those scores and targets, but many more that we have internally.
At the broadest level, I hear a lot in the public about people who are concerned about going to New Hanover Regional Medical Center or sending a loved one there. And these aren't off-the-cuff social media comments. You know, these are intelligent people, well-educated NPR listener types. Are there things that people are misunderstanding about the hospital? I mean, Help me sort of unpack this. Do you guys also have a sense of that? Do you hear this stuff? And do you think that there's some place where the public has misunderstood what's going on at the hospital?
You know, with that, I would say, you know, going back to, we encourage our patients, our families to provide feedback through surveys that they receive post-visit. But we are also, and have been doing for about the last 6 months, some proactive leader rounding with our patients on a daily basis while they're here in our hospital setting. We absolutely, you know, respect each individual patient's perspective, as well as their family's perspective, and learn through those experiences. I will share that, you know, we've seen positive trends in our patient experience scores, as well as, you know, I personally receive multiple letters every week for patients not only thanking us for the care, the technical care that they're receiving, but the compassion and teamwork that they've experienced while they have been here in our care.
Well, those are my questions. And again, I appreciate your time, hoping to have the most well-rounded public conversation about this as possible. I would ask, are there things you feel like you are doing? Because a lot of this is a national issue. People working in the medical field are burning out for a host of reasons that had nothing to do with the Cape Fear region or Novant or New Hanover Regional Medical Center. Are there things you feel Novant is doing that are different or innovative or unique in dealing with what I think is pretty well recognized as a national issue?
I would say that when you ask that question, what I think of is the collaboration that we've got with our team members. Because it's absolutely about setting the environment for them to grow, thrive, and provide the care that they want to. The people that work in healthcare have come to this profession, you know, for a reason. And we want to create that environment for them so that they in turn can provide that high safety, quality care and experience to our patients. So I think looking at, you know, even some of the care models that we've adjusted, looking at how we interact with one another, how we communicate and learn from our patients, you know, we're trialing new things every day and learning as we go. And we will continue to do so with our team members because it's, you know, that's how we're going to create the environment that both our teams want to work in and our patients choose and trust to receive care.
And I'll also add, you know, from my experience and just that this is all, it's deeply personal to both of us and really to all of our team, you know, what we do here and why we do it, which is for our patients. And I can tell you from
personally, I did my residency here. I've been here for almost two decades and working alongside many of the same people and the same teams, and you know, do that because of the culture and the commitments that are here, you know, and have been here for all of these years and continue to be here. And, you know, with this transition to being part of a larger organization, you know, having the resources and expertise and other clinical team members and other leaders who are committed to the same and you know, driving and supporting that same culture, that's why I'm here and why, you know, for myself, my neighbors, are all of our friends, family, you know, that I stay here and continue to want to support that and know that that's the type of people and team I'm surrounded by as well.
And we do want our community to know that. I think each of us has that story, along with Dr. Davis. I myself have been here for, you know, 9 years. You know, I've called this home for 9 years. And after the first five, I moved not only my sister and her whole family, but convinced my mom and dad to move to this area as well, because I do trust and have confidence in the team and the physicians here providing care, because I know if they need care that they're going to get excellent care.
Well, I appreciate you taking time out of what must be incredibly busy schedules and talking to us about this. I will tell you, just on a personal level, when I talk to people, they are concerned about the culture at the hospital and concerned about safety at the hospital. And I don't think all of those concerns are warranted. I think some of those concerns are based on social media, but some of them have been quite jarringly based on real experience. So I appreciate the work you do. I hope you can see the perspective that I see too.
We appreciate you allowing us to have the conversation.
Thanks.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to John Martell, and from Novant, Dr. Heather Davis and Amy Akers, and for WHQR, Ken Campbell. If you've got thoughts, concerns, or ideas for a future show, you can reach us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.